Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Danny Lowney, who is the Managing Director and Founder of 16th Talent. 16th is an influencer talent management company. Among its roster are Carly Rowena, Jack Edwards, and Gabriel Say. Before founding 16th, Danny worked at a consumer tech startup where he was in charge of growth, a key driver of which was influencer marketing.
My name is Danny Lowney. I am the MD at 16th. Which is a digital talent agency here in London.
And let's take it all the way back. I want to know about how you got into the world of influencers. So how did that happen?
Growing up, I was always very, very interested in marketing and in brands. So when I first kind of got the opportunity to have like a proper job, it was doing digital marketing at a sports nutrition brand. And I was kind of the kid in the company, so I was like given the social media thing, which was really cool for me because it was kind of all I knew, and so I would do lots of the content marketing, but also kind of developed like a roster, I suppose, or a range of ambassadors that were fitness models, athletes, people that had maybe some followers on Facebook or Instagram at the time.
Yeah. What year was that in?
Maybe 2012, something like that, and really, really enjoyed it, thoroughly enjoyed working with our talent, finding new people. And at the time we would just send product and built like a whole ambassador program around that, and it was really effective. Then I kind of got very interested in the world of consumer tech startups and the kind of, I suppose, like the Silicon Roundabout scene in London. I became really interested in that and met someone who was running a funded startup. And I thought that was fascinating. I was fascinated by the founder of the company and by its investors and by its
What was the company? What did it do?
It was essentially a social media type app. It was like a messaging based, location based app. It was like a more like consumer focused Find My Friends.
Okay.
And so I started kind of doing growth marketing there. So that would be from product marketing, work on the product from a marketing and growth perspective, but also user acquisition was one of like the things I focused on. And in doing that, I went just again to what I knew, which was influencers. I mean, it was our definitely our most effective channel. It was cool because I had the opportunity to play with a bit of budget there. Nothing crazy, but it was something more than I had before. So I was, from a performance marketing perspective, user acquisition, I was learning a lot about like what does and doesn't work.
How many were in the team?
Four or five. It was a really small team. We were really like, it was like the first year of the team, of the company. And eventually the company, it wasn't going the way they wanted it to, and they were running out of money, so they closed it down. So then that was at the end of 2016, and I was
that VC batch?
Yeah. Exactly. So it was like a pre-revenue startup, so that once you're out of money, you're out of money kind of thing. So that happened. It was a real shame because I was really enjoying that, but it afforded me a great opportunity to kind of sit back, and I'd only just graduated then, so I was kind of figuring out what I want to do with my life. And so I listed all the things I wanted from whatever this next step was. I wrote down things like, if someone were to take a photo of me in the middle of the day, I would like to be smiling, ideally.
I
would like to be able to have autonomy. I can't remember all the stuff that a millennial would like. And then I figured out the four or five options I thought I had, and rated them all, and then got a net score on each. And the top scorer was to start an influencer talent agency, essentially. And the reason being is that I felt like I was maybe playing from the sidelines a little bit. I felt like I really understood influencers, honestly better than most people did, and it felt like I'd kind of developed this expertise almost accidentally.
Yeah, so I suppose you were working before in sort of hiring them for that piece of acquisition for the startup, so it wasn't just this is what the influencer wants, you could also see it from this is what the brand will want from working with that influencer.
Exactly, from an ROI perspective and all of that. So, but I wasn't fully involved, and at the same time, like I would work with a talent maybe, and I would always have very compelling conversations with creators and really enjoy that and get something from it. And I felt like they would get something from it when we would talk, because I would be coming at the conversation from a brand perspective, thinking about them as a brand. I suppose I had a level of frustration that I wasn't wasn't able to kind of help them a bit further. I had the odd opportunity to do that with someone like Gabriel.
So was Gabriel, was that with the startup, or was that
That was pre-startup. Yeah. So that was like, that was actually whilst I was at uni, I started this kind of like side business thing, and I got him to be like our ambassador, like our YouTuber.
So you've always been entrepreneurial?
Maybe, I don't know about that, but like
seeing the, is it working for a startup that you saw go from being funded to running out of money and having to close down,
yeah,
and then you still wanted to like launch your own business, but do you think that did you decide when you were writing that list of things, I don't want to create a startup that needs a lot of investment early doors, because I suppose that's the benefit of agency, the revenue starts coming in.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. It was exactly, I thought exactly that, which was, as much as I love this kind of building environment, building mentality, I don't want to do it this way, because it can work incredibly well, obviously, like we've seen that, but I also saw firsthand how it could really kind of backfire. And I think to raise money, especially to raise quite a bit of money, it covers up fundamental flaws and fills gaps that you wouldn't, that become quite difficult to see. And so I think by not having any money, and I had absolutely no money when I started 16th, a fundamental issue becomes immediate and becomes very, very obvious without even kind of having to look. So you're forced to confront those things rather than having like this buffer where you don't necessarily see everything straight away. So
we have seen some buffers get a bit out of control as well.
I think so.
On a huge level, kind of the WeWorks and the Ubers.
Yeah. I mean, what a WeWork, what an incredible story that's been over the last few months.
I know. And some with just no signs of ever being profitable. I read an interview, I think it was in the FT, with one of the founders of Twitter. His personal wealth was estimated at 1.2 billion. And he was yet to set up a company that was profitable.
Wow.
It's like pretty mega. I think that's US and UK are pretty different.
Sure, yeah. But it's just, it's the same thing, isn't it?
No, there are a few influencer talent agencies already in existence.
Yes.
What was your kind of thought process? Did you want to go down a specific, what was your kind of differentiating factor?
So differentiating factor to begin with was that I knew fitness really well. So I was like, I'll sign the fitness people because I can actually help those people. I'm not going to bother putting myself in a position where I'm not actually going to be very useful. So I just want to be really useful to these people. So I'll go with the stuff that I know, because I knew that audience like the back of my hand. And the reason why that was a real opportunity, and I believe still is one today, is that fitness as kind of a subculture on social media, if you like, I think has been really underestimated and undervalued. And now it's becoming much more obvious. But I think for years, fitness influencers would be seen as just that, as fitness influencers, and a brand or an agency or whatever wouldn't be able to see that just because a guy likes to lift weights 3 times a week or a girl likes to work out in the gym or whatever, just because someone goes to the gym doesn't mean they're justified by that. And so like what I'm getting at is they still consume normal products, just like you and I.
Yeah.
They still go to the cinema, they still drive a car, they still eat crisps.
Yeah.
And
like Gabriel, a great sense of humour.
Yeah, exactly. Have great personalities, have great things to say. There's so much more to them than that. So it was a real cool opportunity for me because I was able to gather this bunch of people, Gabriel, Twice a Hell, a few were in there early on, Megan Grubb, and kind of shine a light on these people. And like these are really interesting people.
Mm.
They have a lot more to them than just leggings and protein powder. And we can really like move product with them. And so it was, I remember when we started a kind of a cornerstone campaign was when Megan worked with Coca-Cola on something around the Jingle Bell Ball, I think it was. And that was awesome for me because like that's exactly what I wanted to show was possible, was that just because someone likes to work out 4 times a week doesn't mean they're not going to affiliate themselves with a brand like Coca-Cola or Jingle Bell Ball.
What's the balance between you going out and pitching your talent to brands and brands, sort of the influencers lead-genning?
Yeah, it's a really interesting insight for us to be looking at, and it's something we've been measuring more over the last 18 months or so. I can say that at any one time it'll be around 60-40 or 40-60 either way, so it definitely does vary. So yeah, you could say on average it's around 50-50, but it does vary for sure. And I think that's because, for example, around Black Friday or around other kind of key commercial events in the calendar, you'll get more inbound stuff because there's more stuff going on. And the other times, we're just turning up the kind of proactive notch. It's like it's very important to me that we remain very, very, very proactive, because otherwise you're at the mercy of trends and of like a macro industry. And I think that's very good place to be.
How did you build your relationships when you came into the industry, and what was the reception like from sort of the lean influencer agencies, the bigger agencies, and where does most of the work, do you do like brand direct, or do you get sort of influencer, digital voices, GOAT?
Yeah. So a couple of things there, I guess. One is, how do I start those relationships? And then two is, I suppose, do we work with brand direct or those kind of intermediary agencies? In the first instance, I think developing those relationships was one of my like highlights, I suppose, of the last 3 years. It was so fun. And for a while, it was just me with my laptop in my backpack running around town and trying to get coffees with people. For quite a while, it was that. I still do that. But it was, so the way I went about it was really, really simple. And because I had worked at a couple of brands before and I tried to use influencers, I knew that there was an issue with talent management when it comes to processes and when it comes to like actually doing work with them as a brand. Because I had tried to give budget to talent before, and it just wasn't possible because I would never hear back from the agency or whatever. So I knew how frustrating it was, and I had a feeling other people would feel that too.
So the talent didn't really know that lots of deals weren't even getting through to them.
Yeah. So I would just ask questions, and again, I still do this. I just ask a lot of questions when I go and meet people, but I did that a lot in the first year, which was just like, what can someone like me do to like make your job easier or make your campaigns more successful from a talent perspective? So I'd ask questions like that, maybe ask slightly awkward questions, and just gather information, and after a while, you start.
Sounds like this podcast.
Yeah, maybe. You start to, I mean, and which you'll have seen in interviewing people, but you do like notice trends, and you do notice things that seem to be norms, and you can kind of build a thesis around that, and that's what we did. So yeah, building relationships in the first instance was actually just me going around asking lots of people questions, which worked really well, and it's something I still like to do because it's really educative. And then in terms of agencies and brands, funnily enough, statistically it's a really similar statistic. It's about 55% of the work we do is with an agency.
Yeah. And is that split over lots of different agencies, or do you
yeah.
tend?
Yeah, absolutely. So that could be those influencer-specific ones you're mentioning. It could be a media agency, it could be a big PR agency.
Which do you prefer working with?
Out of agencies and brands?
No, out of lean agencies.
Oh, got you. Okay, and big ones.
Yeah. And why?
I'm not sure if there's a perfect trend. I would say...
Some quicker?
Yeah, things I like... Yeah, I'm not sure if the trend sits between big and small, honestly, from what I see. I think things that I often see about the smaller agencies is that it's sometimes easier to get to the crux of an issue. But I mean, as I'm saying that, I'm actually doubting that, because when you're working with a smaller agency, you're often working with a bigger agency, but you just don't know it, or you don't see it.
And what do you think about that?
It's frustrating. I can see what happens. Like, if I'm a big agency and I've got 200 grand to spend, and I've sorted 100 grand of that spend, but I've still don't know what the hell to do with this other 100. I can give that to a small agency and they'll sort it out because I've got 7 other clients to look after. I get that. But from a talent perspective, it's quite frustrating because in terms of approving content, feedback, getting to the bottom of what the brief actually is and what's actually trying to be.
And how much money actually was budgeted for
it. Yeah, it's difficult because there's this big kind of grey cloud that no one can really see through. So for example, if we're starting to work on a campaign, and we and the talent are keen to know what's the actual point of the campaign, what's the kind of KPI, what does the brand care about, just to inform how we're going to respond to it, we can ask that question, and they don't necessarily know because they're kind of a bit too far down the chain. So I suppose all that said, I actually probably prefer working with the bigger agencies because I think you're closer to the heart of the campaign. But I don't think it's fair to say that's true in all cases.
Mm. Would you ever want to sort of move into the agency side as well? Like, we've seen Gleam Futures launch Gleam Solutions,
yeah.
Their sort of agency branch. Is that on your trajectory?
No, it's not. I would say, I mean, anything can happen, anything can change. But my position on that for the last 3 years has been very consistent, which is it's not interesting to me. There are plenty of people who should be better at us than that. And I think it's fundamentally flawed, because if you are protecting the interests of a brand, a client, but also simultaneously protecting the interests of your own talent, that's like an error. That would not compute.
Because there are some that it's like if you're within our talent pool, then you will get first dibs on the brand stuff, which might not necessarily be the best person for that campaign for the brand.
Yeah, or almost necessarily won't be the best person. I just don't get it. And I get it from a commercial perspective in the short term, but in terms...
Yeah, it will be lead genning.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I can see why. Like, it's tempting maybe when you get an amazing brief and you can't service it with your talent, so you think, oh, how else can we do this? Or you think, oh, actually, we could probably over-service this. I can see why that would be good for the bottom line over the next 12 or 24 months. Absolutely makes sense. But for me and for 16th, it's just not interesting. I think if we're serious about our ambitions, we need to be serious about focusing on the one thing we're good at.
What is the favourite campaign that you've done working with your talent?
Oh, that's such a difficult question.
Maybe not in such kind of finite terms. One of your favourites.
One of them. Okay, that makes it a bit easier. Yeah,
so you don't offend the other talent. I worked really hard on that.
This is really just going off the top of my head. But one that stands out is for a similar reason to when I referred to that Coca-Cola one, is Google Pixel Book and Gabriel Say. That was the first time Gabe worked with a brand that was like really kind of a mainstream consumer brand. It was such a great feeling because all the work we had put into kind of helping him position himself and move on from being like this big jacked guy, it was like real validation of that. It was amazing. But that was early on, honestly. And so since then, we've done a ton of cool stuff.
What would you, if you could eradicate a form of like influence marketing, what would it be and why?
So I suppose an easy answer is like forced product placement, visually speaking.
Yeah, do you think that we have reached the peak of that and that will improve now?
I think so. I would like to think
so,
honestly.
Is it going to get worse still before it gets better?
I mean, probably will get a little bit worse before it gets better, but I feel like the whip has kind of changed direction and now it's just that long tail that's going to like... I think the industry has moved on from it, but the result or the product probably hasn't quite moved on. We'll probably still see it for a while, won't we? But I think that stuff is just unbelievably bad. And it's just a terrible idea. I don't know why a talent would want to do that. I don't know why their management would want them to do that. I don't know why the agency would want that to happen. I don't know why the brand would want that.
I think we'll get more creative again.
I hope so.
But I suppose that is dependent on budget. And although we're seeing more budget come into influence marketing, it just feels like it's spread quite thin. And they expect less money to do way more. I was actually speaking, I can't remember who it was, about the Dracula ad, that outdoor asset but made for social. But there are, I think I saw it on LinkedIn, and there were kind of 10 people working on that. Imagine if you had 10 people around an influencer on a creative strategy, just creating something even better. Mm. And yes, it would take more money, but the results, not only would you already have the audience because it's inbuilt, but you'd actually be doing something really cool.
Mm. I think I would love to see, so part of our mission as a company is to change the way that influencers are perceived. And one of the kind of changes in perception we would like to move towards is to see them and to appreciate them as creatives, because when they're at their best, they really, really, truly are. And I would love to see brands position influencers as that creative. And I know that might not sound great to like a creative agency. And that, to be honest, if I was a creative agency, I wouldn't be too worried about that changing things so much right now. But I would love to bring an influencer to the table for that conversation and have them involved in the core creative of a campaign at the very, very top, at the very, very first stage. Because
they need to be seen beyond just audience.
Absolutely. Absolutely, or the good ones do anyway.
Yeah.
And I think one of the cool things about this space becoming like very, very saturated and there being a bigger supply of talent is that the cream will rise to the top, or whatever the phrase is, and there will be a big separation between those who like are actually creative and those who aren't. And I think once we get there, and maybe that will become more clear as well, I think hopefully brands will kind of harness that value and respect that value a bit more.
Would you ever sign celebrity influencers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would, because I mean that's a quick yes, isn't it? but yeah, there's no reason why I wouldn't. If they were truly a good influence, if they understood like digital content and the importance that digital plays in like a traditional world, and they're very willing to lean into that, then absolutely yes. Because I'm actually really interested in that as a thing. I would love to be part of I suppose, bridging the gap in some way. And I really respect how The Rock has done that with his kind of digital strategy, and that there's a
like
handful
Facebook
of others.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a handful of kind of traditional celebrities who have kind of embraced a really good digital strategy, and it's so amazing. Jack Black, I don't know if you saw, he launched his YouTube channel last year. I think it was brilliant. It so rarely happens, and it's almost a little too late.
Yeah.
In that, I would love to be part of building a talent that would, without us, would just be a traditional celeb, but with us becomes this kind of hybrid monster. I'd love that.
If you could sign one traditional celebrity and one digital first, like a traditional celebrity influencer and a digital first influencer, if you're allowed one of each, who would they be?
For the first one, it would maybe be like a top athlete or a, I mean, I'm a big basketball fan, so maybe it would be a top basketball player. Or a rising basketball player, or I would love to sign Barack Obama. I think would be amazing.
Yeah.
Or again, like a rising politician. I'm really interested to see when the first kind of elected politician will come from being a quote unquote influencer. Mm. That's 100% going to happen.
There's a woman in the US, I can't remember her name, so it hasn't yet sunk in.
Yeah.
Her name is, but she seems to trend on Twitter.
Yeah.
And across, and I think she, from very humble beginnings, maybe worked in bakery or something. This is like not fact checked at all, but she really holds people to account, and
yeah,
everyone really gets behind
her. Yeah.
So that could be,
and then I think like Andrew Chen, who's in the Democratic Party race right now, he's got a really good social strategy. But what I'm referring to is like someone who started on uploading videos to YouTube or to IGTV.
Yeah.
Or something like that. That's going to happen. So I would love to be part of that.
Digital. Yeah. Digital influencer.
I was trying to avoid this part.
Anyone in the world.
You
can poach them from someone else as well.
Ooh, thank you very much, Alice. A slight knee-jerk reaction. You want an answer. So I think Emma Chamberlain is brilliant. I really, really respect her. And I think if we were to work with someone like that, it would be game over. So I'm going to say Emma Chamberlain because I think she's awesome.
Perfect. What are your biggest frustrations about the influencer space?
I have to say, I don't find it that frustrating. I'm very excited by it all.
Well, what are you most excited about as well?
I'm excited at the fact that it's in such a healthy place, in that it's getting a lot of attention, and I think it's really fun to be part of something that people actually care about.
Do you think there's enough money for everyone to survive, or do you think we'll see some consolidation in the next few years? Because I feel like, I mean, we're in quite a sort of independent position, so we can talk to lots of different people, but sometimes it feels like not many people talk to each other and get very competitive about, you know, keeping on to kind of clients.
Yeah. I expect there to be a lot more money put into the space over the next 5 or 10 years. But at the same time, I think the money should and will be spent better and with more strategy, which means that, like, NAF players should probably pack up.
Mm. Strategy is really a...
Yeah.
More strategy.
Yeah, I think so. And so I do think that, like, again, like, we'll see a big separation, and people who have been able to survive off kind of the boom, or however you might want to describe that, people who have been able to survive off just being a byproduct of an exciting industry, I think they should hopefully kind of leave.
Do you ever have people that pretend that they rep your talent?
No, I don't think so. Anyway, that would be problematic. But no, I mean, actually,
a few people do that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, you're
and
right.
And then they'll get in touch with you. You're like, yeah, I've got a deal that I think would be good for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they've said that they are.
Yeah, we've had. There's been a couple of times where I know someone's trying to do that.
Yeah.
Except I'm just not interested in it. It's just a mess. But no, thankfully not.
What's been your worst experience since launching a company?
Honestly, like, I know this is maybe annoying, but anything that's been really difficult, I find it hard to kind of think about as a bad thing, because one, it's an inevitability. This stuff is not supposed to be easy. Starting a business and growing it to any kind of scale, albeit a very small scale still, but is supposed to be difficult. And the amount I've learned in doing this is unbelievable. So I find it hard not to appreciate that. But I would say, like, my hardest days or my hardest weeks or my hardest months have been, it's a very, very people first business, isn't it? We manage talent. Our product, if you like, is a human. We have like quite a few staff now, and we deal with people. So, like, it's all people. Like, everywhere you look, it's people. The biggest challenges come from, like, people first conversations.
Have you ever considered having a co-founder because you're a sole founder?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've considered it like, oh, that would be nice, but no more than that. And I think I can.
Do you have a board? No.
No.
Yeah.
But
who do you lean on? Like, do you have any mentors?
Question. Yeah. Yeah. It's something I've been also in the last, I would say, 18 months been kind of focusing on more. So from about September, October 2018, I started putting more emphasis on kind of building out a team of, let's call them informal mentors or coaches. And in the last 6 months, I've been formalizing that more. And now it's actually something that we're going to be like expanding to the business, because we are a very young team and we're relatively inexperienced. So what we've been doing is kind of building out slowly but surely this team of kind of external coaches, if you like, because just how like a team has in athletics will have a coach, or a sports team will have a coach, it's really important to have those kind of figures. So we're building that out now.
Hmm. And you've talked previously about your favorite book being Ego is the Enemy.
Mm.
I agree. but is that kind of, do you make your team read it?
Yeah. And it's required reading.
Yeah.
So if we employ someone new, I order a copy on Amazon and send it out to the home address before they start. That reminds me, I need to do that today. It has been like,
I mean, it kind of summarizes what it is in the title.
It does a little bit, but there is, it's more interesting than just the name. And the reason being is that it's not just about you, funnily enough. It's also about understanding when ego's at play in other people. And so when you perhaps meet someone or come across someone or come across a situation, and there seems to be this kind of almost unexplainable problem that you can't quite put your finger on, perhaps that's because there's this weird thing in there called ego. And so just becoming aware of that and becoming more kind of conscious of how you might navigate that is very, very powerful. And at the same time, being able to like recognize your own ego and limit your own ego is really powerful as well. That book, it means so much to me, because like there's no way I would have been able to like work on 16th for the last 3 years if I had not kind of studied that book and held it as like a core philosophy.
Do you sometimes feel though that being sort of so open and showing vulnerabilities can sort of be a risk in business?
I think it's probably a risk, but business is risky.
I suppose it means people are generally more likely to like you, and people help people that they like.
You'd like to think so. I think the long game matters, or for me anyway, it's really important. Like longevity is really important, reputation is really important. So I don't think there's any other way. And I think I also think it's an easy win. People are like ridden with ego issues. Everyone is. But yeah, do I think it's a risk? Probably, but it's also just like, it just feels right. I think it's probably more risky to be like not yourself or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know, I agree. Do you think that we're seeing more longer term partnerships develop with influencers?
Definitely. Yeah, I think it was maybe at the start of, I think it was that transition between 2018 and 2019. Everyone was talking about it and everyone was like, oh, this year it'll be the year of the long term partnership. And I definitely think that changed the conversation a little bit, but certainly by now, I think it's really, really taken effect, and way more of the kind of more informed agencies we speak with are like really pushing for that with their clients. When we're speaking with a client direct, they'll be more interested in that now, which I think is really great. It's a really, really good sign, because it's clearly, I think, the most impactful way to work with influencers is depth rather than width. I'd rather have 5 influencers post 20 pieces of content than 100 influencers post 1 piece of content personally, if I were a brand. So I think depth is really, really important, and I do think that people are really understanding it now, and it's actually happening. Mm. We're definitely seeing that.
What are your relationships like as a talent agency with the ASA and the CAP? Because I suppose you need to be on top of that for your talent.
Absolutely.
What do you think of the sort of regulations and how they're moving? And I know we saw, say, a traditional sort of Molly, well, she started off as an influencer actually, digital influencer Molly May, but the ruling with her and Pretty Little Thing, that she was wearing it and it was tagged, but it wasn't an ad, even though it wasn't a paid for piece of content, but she was an ambassador. Do you feel that they're clear and that you can say with conviction to your talent what the rules are now?
Yeah, I mean, they're not clear. That much is clear. But I think they're clear enough that people who, if it's your job, you can be sure. So I feel like we're very sure of what to advise now, mainly because Rachel on our team is an absolute ASA nerd. So she's been really good for that. So we definitely lean on her for that specifically. But I do think that the frameworks they give are unclear, but they're clear enough for professionals to interpret and give advice on. I'm happy that they're there because I do think the industry like needs that kind of
professionalization.
Yeah, exactly. It needs to grow up a little bit. But at the same time, like the marketer in me thinks it's a bit of a shame sometimes because I know how it might change things. Like everyone says how marketers ruin everything. But I kind of feel like the ASA maybe ruin everything as well in a way. I mean, I mean that jokingly because of course like we need that stuff. But at the same time, like 5 years ago, how easy was it to use an influencer and to like to build a story and to build a narrative from the kind of like the shadows.
Do you ever get brands sort of approaching you and saying that they don't want it to be disclosed?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah. And I think once you kind of lean on regulations and just kind of advise in a friendly or helpful way, they usually kind of think, oh shit, yeah.
Sometimes on the flip side of that, brands are very deliberate in saying that they do want the ad there, and by the time it gets through to the talent don't put it there, and then if it does get called up, then the fine gets split between the talent and the brand itself.
Yeah, I think it makes sense because if the talent's not managed or they're not managed properly, that stuff might not be, like you still see it every single day, there's mistakes that people make, big mistakes, silly mistakes. And so I think that if I were a brand, I would definitely enforce it in contracts, things like that, because just to make sure you don't know exactly how clued up the other person is. And if they're unmanaged talent, they might not know. That's unfair, like some unmanaged talent will know really, really well. But still, like you can't assume that everyone's at that level.
Just back to the startup, you're working on the customer acquisition point, which gave you a good overview of return on investment.
Yeah.
Where do you think that the influencer marketing industry is going with the return on investment, and how can it improve, and what kind of, are you being asked, you know, is it more trackable links? Are there kind of units of sale now that are being part of the conversations? Do you think that's a good thing, or do you think we're losing that actually it's sort of brand positioning and placement?
So as a marketer, the return on investment stuff is really exciting to me. However, I think like every channel, every like strategy, marketing strategy has its time. And I think 5 years ago, you could start a consumer brand, direct to consumer brand, use influencers for pretty much nothing, and you could absolutely kill it. And now you can't. And that is just how the world works.
Gymshark got on a very good wave.
Amazing. Yeah. Like absolutely right time, right market, all that stuff. So that I think we have to accept that it shouldn't be as easy now because everything gets harder every single day. It should do. That's how the world works. But from a 16th perspective, I think brands need to appreciate what they're buying when they buy an influencer and the value that's coming to the table. It is not just a media buy, as I know you know so well. It's so much more than that. And I think one of the most compelling values of an influencer is brand perception. For example, I think that's really strong. I've seen brands that I think are naff, that I've seen a cool, someone who I deem to be cool, I've seen them work with them, and I'm like, oh, it's not such a naff brand, actually. And like, so I think brand perception and like positioning, which is what it is one of the most like powerful values in influencer marketing. So if you're an influencer and I'm a brand and I'm gonna pay you per acquisition or per click or whatever, I'm not recognizing the fact that you're making my brand look cooler, which is really, really valuable because that's going to increase the value of all the other marketing.
How do you get them to understand that?
I mean, by saying that, hopefully I put it in a way that makes some kind of sense. But and then sometimes you're not, and then they're not the right client.
I find people are quite lazy now, and that they just want, I want this many clicks.
Yeah, but and I think that's why
you've aligned with someone that's built up an audience for 7 years.
And I think so. It's just about having like principles and like. There's a line, and like we just don't go near those deals anymore, those conversations, because you can tell when someone's not going to be convinced and it's not worth having the conversation. You just move on.
Very interesting. Finally, what are your predictions for the next sort of year, 2 years within the influencer space?
I suppose, as an optimist, I do think that brands will start including influencer earlier in the conversation. We have seen this already. And what I mean by that is when it comes to product development or campaign ideation or like messaging, like writing messaging. I think we've already seen that influencers have been involved at that stage now. Like M&S did something really cool last year, didn't they? With I think a shoe collection. That's a brand that you would not have expected to bring out like an influencer line. So I think
it did really well.
Yeah, good. It, from what I saw, I remember it looking amazing. And I think we'll definitely see more of that, which is good. Like a recognition of the kind of the big mainstream brands of what people like, brands like In The Style or Gymshark or whatever, a recognition of what they've done, and that's really meaningful. They move real numbers. So I think we'll see that more. And I think we'll see, we'll be walking down the aisle in Tesco, or we'll be at Topshop, or we'll be at another big retailer, and we'll see more like influencer-inspired messaging or influencer-inspired products or collections or edits, that kind of thing. We're definitely seeing more of that. So I expect that to be more prevalent, and I expect that that influencers, the good ones, will be included earlier in kind of creative conversations.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much
thank
for coming
you.
On the show.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for the feature.
Oh.
With Gabriel and I in the last issue. That was very surreal and I really, really appreciate it. That was really cool.
Thank you.
A big thanks to Danny for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogosphere.magazine.com. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?